became the hot read of the season. Everyone who read it knew it was going to be great. I read it and immediately called those same agents who'd gotten me LAX 2194. "You have to get me on Friends Like Us," I said. "Not going to happen," my agent said. "You're attached to the baggage handler show. They've already measured you for your futuristic shirt and everything." I was devastated. When I read the script for Friends Like Us, it was as if someone had followed me around for a year, stealing my jokes, copying my mannerisms, photocopying my world-weary yet witty view of life. One character in particular stood out to me. It wasn't that I thought I could play Chandler. I was Chandler. But I was also Blaine in LAX 2194. Fuck me. Is everyone kidding? Am I the least lucky person on the planet? It got worse. Because Friends Like Us was the hot ticket of the season, everyone was reading it. Everyone was auditioning for it, and everyone, it seemed, decided the part of Chandler was exactly like me, and came to my apartment to ask me to help them with their auditions. A few went a long way based on my choices and my choices alone. Hank Azaria thought it was so good, he auditioned for it twice, for the role of Joey. That's right, he auditioned for it, got passed on, begged and pleaded to go in again, and got passed on again. Later, Hank would be Phoebe's romantic interest for a few episodes, performances for which he won an Emmy. I did 237 episodes and won nothing. I ended up knowing the script of Friends Like Us pretty much off by heart because I'd practiced it so much with my pals. In fact, there were times I just acted Chandler out for them and told them to copy what I'd done, so sure that it was the right way to play him. And still, I would call my agents every 3 or 4 days begging for a chance. Now, we're forgetting about Craig Bierko, the hottest ticket in town. One morning, Craig called Hank and me to breakfast, and as we walked in, we saw Craig sitting at a table with two scripts open in front of him. "Guys," Craig said, "I've been offered two shows. Jim Burrows, the hottest director in Hollywood, is directing both. One is called Best Friends, and the other one is called Wait, Wait, Don't Say It, Please Don't Say It, Friends Like Us." He had been offered the role of Chandler. It made my head explode. "And I need you to tell me which one to take." My first instinct was to tell him he could take his jobs and go fuck himself. But he was a close friend, so Hank and I obliged. The three of us read the two scripts that morning, though I already knew Friends Like Us off by heart, and it was clear which one he should take. My heart sank because I knew I was Chandler, but I also wasn't an asshole. I was crushed. We both told Craig to do Friends Like Us. This made me think of an exchange from my episode on Beverly Hills 90210. Brandon, "What about Friends?" Roger, "Friends? My father says those are the only ones you can't trust." Brandon, "Do you always listen to him?" Roger, "No." Lunch was winding down, and it was time for Craig to tell his agents where his head was at. Hank made his goodbyes and went to the gym, because he was always going to the gym, and I went with Craig as he looked for a payphone. No cell phones, folks. This was 1994. The nearest one was outside a Fred Siegel store, the same store that weirdly also features in my episode of Beverly Hills 90210. Craig threw a few coins in the machine, tapped in his numbers, and waited. Eventually, they patched him through. And then I stood 2 feet away from Craig and listened to him pick the other show. I couldn't believe my fucking ears. So the new lead of Best Friends and I parted ways. I raced home to make another plea to get an audition for Friends Like Us. A few weeks later, I went to the taping of the pilot of Best Friends. It was funny, Craig was funny, and the lead, which is what I really think he wanted. Perfectly fine, cute show, but the final role available during the entire pilot season of 1994, Chandler, in Friends Like Us, was still not cast. And I was still attached to the fucking futuristic baggage handler show. You know how sometimes the universe has plans for you that are hard to believe? How the world wants something for you even though you've done your best to close off that avenue? Welcome to My 1994. NBC producer Jamie Tarsus, oh, sweet, magical, much-missed Jamie Tarsus, who was helping to develop Friends Like Us at NBC, apparently turned to her then-husband, Dan McDermott, a Fox TV producer, one night in bed. "Hey, is the show LAX-2194 gonna get picked up?" Jamie reportedly said. Dan said, "No, it's awful. For a start, it's about baggage handlers in the year 2194. They wear futuristic vests." "So, is Matthew Perry available? A safe second position?" Jamie said. That's Hollywood speak for available. Ironically, Jamie and I would date for several years much later, after she got divorced. A couple of days later, I got the phone call that would change my life. "You're meeting Marta Kaufman about Friends Like Us tomorrow." And this is no lie. I knew right then and there just how huge it was all going to be. Marta Kaufman, along with David Crane, was the person most responsible for what would become Friends. Next day, a Wednesday, I read as Chandler for her. I broke all the rules. For a start, I didn't carry any pages of the script. You're supposed to carry the script with you when you read, because that way you're acknowledging to the writers that it's just a work in progress. But I knew the script so well by this point, of course I nailed it. Thursday, I read for the production company and nailed it. And Friday, I read for the network. Nailed it again. I read the words in an unexpected fashion, hitting emphases that no one else had hit. I was back in Ottawa with the Murrays. I got laughs where no one else had. I was cheering up my mother. And Chandler was born. This was my part now, and there was no stopping it. The pilot season of 1994 had cast its final actor, Matthew Perry as Chandler Bing. That phone call at Fred Siegel's and Craig's desire to be the star of his own show, rather than be part of an ensemble, saved my life. I don't know what would have happened to me had the call gone the other way. It is not out of the realms of possibility that I may have ended up on the streets of downtown LA shooting heroin in my arm until my untimely death. I would have loved heroin. It was my opiate addiction on steroids. I've often said that taking OxyContin is like replacing your blood with warm honey. But with heroin, I would imagine you are the honey. I loved the feeling of opiates. But something about the word heroin always scared me. And it is because of that fear that I'm still alive today. There are two kinds of drug addicts, the ones who want to go up and the ones that want to go down. I could never understand the coke guys. Why would anybody want to feel more present, more busy? I was a downer guy. I wanted to melt into my couch and feel wonderful while watching movies over and over again. I was a quiet addict, not the bull in a china shop kind. Sure, without Friends, I may have had a career as a sitcom writer. I had already written a pilot called Maxwell's House, but though I had some skills, it hadn't sold. But there was no way I could have been a journeyman actor. I wouldn't have stayed sober for that. It was not worth not doing heroin for that. Friends was such a good and fun job that it curtailed everything for a while at least. I was the second baseman for the New York Yankees. I couldn't fuck that up. I would never forgive myself. When you're earning $1 million a week, you can't afford to have the 17th drink. About 3 weeks before my audition for Friends, I was alone in my apartment on Sunset and Doheny, 10th floor. It was very small, but it had a great view, of course. And I was reading the newspaper about Charlie Sheen. It said that Sheen was yet again in trouble for something, but I remember thinking, what does he care? He's famous. Out of nowhere, I found myself getting to my knees, closing my eyes tightly and praying. I had never done this before. God, you can do whatever you want with me. Just please make me famous. 3 weeks later, I got cast in Friends, and God has certainly kept his side of the bargain. But the Almighty, being the Almighty, had not forgotten the first part of that prayer as well. Now, all these years later, I'm certain that I got famous, so I would not waste my entire life trying to get famous. You have to get famous to know that it's not the answer. And nobody who's not famous will ever truly believe that. Interlude, Dead. I bought her a ring because I was desperate that she would leave me. I didn't want to be this injured and alone during COVID. I was high on 1,800 milligrams of hydrocodone when I asked her to marry me. I had even asked for her family's blessing. Then I'd proposed, high as a kite, and on one knee, and she knew it too, and said yes. I was in Switzerland at the time, at yet another rehab. This one was at a villa on Lake Geneva with its own butler and chef, the kind of luxurious place where you were guaranteed to not meet anybody else, thereby pretty much defeating the purpose of every rehab I had ever heard of. But what it lacked in fellow sufferers, it made up for in easy availability of drugs, which again, unfortunately, did not differentiate it from other high-priced rehabs. I could make millions if I sued these places, but it would divert more attention to the situation, which I didn't want to do. I did my usual trick, complaining about intense stomach pain when in fact I was okay. It still felt like I was constantly doing a sit-up, so it was very uncomfortable, but it wasn't pain. So, they'd given me hydrocodone, as much as I could actually feel, which turned out to be 1,800 milligrams a day. To put that in perspective, if you broke your thumb and had a kind doctor, he or she would probably prescribe you 5.5 milligram pills. Not enough to put a dent in this guy. I was also doing ketamine infusions every day. Ketamine was a very popular street drug in the 80s. There is a synthetic form of it now, and it's used for two reasons: to ease pain and help with depression. Has my name written all over it. They might as well have called it Maddie. Ketamine felt like a giant exhale. They'd bring me into a room, sit me down, put headphones on me so I could listen to music, blindfold me, and put an IV in. That was the hard part. I'm always a little dehydrated because I don't drink enough water. Big surprise. So finding a vein was no fun. I was like a fucking pincushion by the end of it. Into the IV went a smidge of Ativan, which I could actually feel, and then I was on a ketamine drip for an hour. As I lay there in the pitch dark listening to Bon Iver, I would disassociate, see things. I'd been in therapy for so long that I wasn't even freaked out by this. Oh, there's a horse over there? Fine, might as well be. As the music played and the K ran through me, it all became about the ego and the death of the ego, and I often thought I was dying during that hour. Oh, I thought, this is what happens when you die. Yet I would continually sign up for this shit because it was something different, and anything different is good, which just so happens to be one of the last lines of Groundhog Day. Taking K is like being hit in the head with a giant happy shovel. But the hangover was rough and outweighed the shovel. Ketamine was not for me. Back in my room, the butler had laid out more clothes I wouldn't change into, the chef had prepared yet another healthy meal I wouldn't touch, and I went back to looking at Lake Geneva a lot, completely fucking high. But not the good kind of high, a loopy, drunk feeling that I did not enjoy. I was also now, somehow, engaged. At some point, the rehab geniuses decided that to help my stomach pain, they'd put some kind of weird medical device in my back, but they'd need to do a surgery to insert it. So I stayed up all night, taking 1,800 milligrams of hydrocodone, for the next day's surgery. In the operating room, they gave me propofol, you know, the drug that killed Michael Jackson. I learned then and there that Michael Jackson didn't want to be high. He wanted to be out. Zero consciousness. and yet another masterful talent taken from us by this terrible disease. I was given the shot at 11 a.m. I woke up 11 hours later in a different hospital. Apparently, the propofol had stopped my heart for 5 minutes. It wasn't a heart attack, I didn't flatline, but nothing had been beating. If I may be so bold, please pause your listening of this audiobook for 5 minutes. Look at your phone, starting now. That's a fucking long time, right? I was told that some beefy Swiss guy really didn't want the guy from Friends dying on his table and did CPR on me for the full 5 minutes, beating and pounding my chest. If I hadn't been on Friends, would he have stopped at 3 minutes? Did Friends save my life again? He may have saved my life, but he also broke 8 of my ribs. As I lay there in agony the following day, the head doctor waltzed in, all full of himself, and said, "You will get no ketamine here, and if you need to go to a rehab, there is one we can send you to." "I'm already in fucking rehab," I screamed, and in a rare show of physical anger, I knocked over the table next to me, which was covered in medical supplies. This scared the doctor, and he promptly left the room. I apologized for the mess I had made and got the hell out of there. The rehab I was speaking of had already done a rapid detox, but they put me under for the wrong 2 days. The first two. It should have been days 3 and 4. By the time I came around, the detox fully hit, and I'd gone from 1,800 milligrams to bupkis. Not much a butler and a chef can do about that. Those 8 broken ribs were, by the way, much the same injury that the New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees suffered in a game in November 2021 against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Brees would break 3 more the following week and puncture his lung just to be better than me. But then he missed 4 games, so I'd argue we're at least even, which makes me feel tough. Right in the middle of all this madness, but prior to the rib thing, I took a meeting with Adam McKay about a movie called Don't Look Up. There was no Chandler that day. I wasn't on. I couldn't get it up for that. We just talked for a while, and as I walked out, I said very calmly, "Well, I'd love to help you in any way I can with this thing." Adam said, "I think you just did." I got the call the following day that he was hiring me. This would be the biggest movie I'd gotten yet. It promised to be a little calm within the storm. I was to play a Republican journalist and was supposed to have 3 scenes with Meryl Streep. Yes, that's right. I got to do a group scene with Jonah Hill, among others, in Boston where the movie was filmed. I was on 1,800 milligrams of hydrocodone then, too, but nobody noticed. But with the broken ribs, there was no way I could continue. So I never got to do my scenes with Meryl. It was heartbreaking, but I was in too much pain. God knows how Breeds continued to throw a football, but you don't get to do a scene with Meryl Streep with broken ribs, and I couldn't smile without it hurting like fuck. Being in Don't Look Up didn't work out because my life was on fire, but I learned an important lesson. I was hireable in something big without putting on a show. In that meeting, Adam and I had just been 2 men talking. I will treasure that moment, that day, that man. What a good guy, and I sincerely hope our paths cross again. I'll be sure to check it's actually him next time. When it came time to leave Switzerland, I was still on 1,800 milligrams of oxy every single fucking day. I was told that once back in Los Angeles, I'd still be able to get that much, and I needed it. Just to stay on level. As ever, this was not getting me high. This was purely maintenance, so I didn't go through agonies. I flew back on a private jet. There was no way I could fly commercial, given that everyone in the world recognized my damn face, and it cost me a cool $175,000 to do so. Back in L.A., I went to see my doctor. "I need 1,800 milligrams a day," I said. "No point beating around the bush." Oh, no, she said. We're not giving you that at all. Cancer patients only get 100 milligrams. This only upped my gratitude that I didn't have cancer. But the doctor in Switzerland told me that's what I'd be on when I got home. Oh, they'll consult, she said, but I'm in charge now. Here's 30 milligrams. This would not do. I would get incredibly sick.